He could not insist on his functioning in a certain way, although he was a fully fledged police officer by law.
Mm-hmm. What kind of weight did he carry?
Quite a lot. In the village, if he had made the right choice, certainly a lot of it. And a good village judgment could be very useful indeed in two ways. The first policeman on the scene of an offense, the best informant to the distant police station of how things were in the village. Requirement of patrolling, requirement of visits by the uniformed police, all that depending a great deal on his.
In a complicated case, say a murder case, were these people likely to mix, close up and...
Definitely. So we had a system of special... Excuse me, sir, voice there. Simon... But we... They would certainly spoil a case through either through indifference or over keenness, either. So we started, I started our British IG, Sir Herbert Dowbiggin, had started a scheme of instruction by the police to Herbert. This was in groups of village judgment in rural areas, and give them instruction in preliminary investigation. This was not part of their training or any requirement or qualification at time of appointment. They were just taken from the village and made to do this. But we started training them in what was required in them from them at the first basic place. We found a lot of them absorbed the training and they did their stuff.
How was the liaison between
the between the village and the village? Good. As a general rule, good. Because where there was a breakdown, the headman used to say the police were to blame and vice versa, you just couldn't help them. Well, actually, if you sit there, it might be easier to pass the telephone. I think that might be a better filter. You said, stop, sir. No, we forget what we were talking about, unless you keep your mind very fixed on it. We were talking about...
I think we had covered that
place.
What about the question of the relations between these British officers and the Sudanese public at a time when there was this nationalist British overlord conflict, you know, and they were called imperialists? I presume the police officers were naturally considered the striking force
of imperialism. That is correct. And there is no gainsaying the fact that the general attitude of the British officer and our seniors was one of complete intolerance of any nationalist effort or feeling. But I must say that as a general rule, they had very great discretion and tact in actual demonstration of any such attitude. If it came to some violent riot or something like that, of course, they took an action, so it would be on the grounds of this conflict against law and order. But otherwise, in matter of general meetings and public speeches and all, they just let it go.
Now, I was wondering whether there were one or two or three who tended to show open arrogance sometimes and made a bad name for the police as a whole.
I wouldn't put it that way. There are some of them who were more positive in taking, shall we say, counteraction, and therefore arouse more bitter reaction in our own politicians, who then in turn accused them publicly in Parliament and other places of arrogance. But I do not recall, it's long ago, I do not recall any officer who was deliberately oppressive or arrogant or anything like that. In their attitude, mentally, definitely, it was one of arrogance, even to us who were their brother officers. But I think they were very schooled and they didn't adopt, for instance, the attitude of Indian police officers, of whose doing we used to read and which we have come across. Our chapter, little, I would say, definitely more educated, if you can put it that way, or refined in their general behavior. The feelings were not always sure.
After 1931, I should have thought that they were in a rather nebulous under the Minister of Home Affairs, who was a civilian. But, say, taking the IGP, his ultimate loyalty would have been over the Home Affairs Minister to the British government.
Yes.
And there would have been a, could, at least in theory, have been some sort of conflict.
Yes, it not only could have been, he had direct access to the Governor General. So that's the way the matter is concerned, you see. He had direct access. Although he was under the Prime Minister, for normal purposes of admission, in matters of security, he had direct access. And that is where you are practical. In regard to crime investigation and internal things like that, well, that's really, the Home Minister says that we should set about it this way, they're quite prepared to cooperate. In security matters, they reserve the right to go to the Chief Secretary or to the government.
Well, I wonder what happened in the West Berlin.
Well, that was one of the cases that was in my mind at the time. The West Berlin was deported, and there was a bit of a row about it. And when the Communist Party or the Samajwadists raised the question, the Home Minister, I think, was Sir D.B. Jaffer, he tried to put it entirely on the police. Or to pretend that there had been no political direction at all. Well, fortunately or unfortunately, Mr. Banks, who had been the AIDCID, was able to prove that it was political, that the civilian politician had been aware of all the action, and then it proved it not actually directed.
He was a plural. Was it only Jadrika who was aware of it, or had he asked the whole...
I think two or three others. It was proven because the inquiry had known and had discussed the matter. So Mr. Banks became very unpopular with the civilians, politically speaking, because he proved the truth in that particular matter.
Why was President reported?
Purely because he was considered an undesirable. And from the point of view of policy at the time, he was a communist, he was an important communist agitator. That was the answer. So I can't think of it. At that time, you were not senior enough to know what was going on in the special branch of the CID. The special branch of the CID is always a very, very secret department, naturally. So even the military service would not know all the facts.
No, I think
there
was a fear that he would have a white plant or so, he was creeping through. He would stir up estate labor.
More than that, his capacity to stir up estate labor, and he would have brought the British plants and others, he would have given a different picture of them to the labor, you see? And by that means, they thought it would undermine the prestige of the British rulers and the plants and everybody.
Yes. I don't suppose the British beachcombers and sort, beach mixed devaring would have been very something that day.
No, definitely not. Hardly. Very few. There's one or two cases of such remittance men from home. But the minute they got really low in their living, they were quietly packed off.
Did your superiors then have any fear that the nationalist movement here would take the turn it had taken in India and become a
violent one? Well, naturally, all the time, we were taking the example of India. We had all these reports on the Indian Special Branch, in which we were instructed. And we kept watching for any development on those lines. But I don't think our people here had the character and quality of the Indian people. So it didn't happen. And we went along, we came along, behind India. We got all the advantages of what the Indian people did in their struggle without our church doing any portion of that. Even our own independence, and the great result of independence which India was doing.
But I presume that meant that the special branch did keep an eye on our more violent nationalists or the more militant sorts.
Not only on the militant sorts. Special branch kept a very careful watch. Any type of nationalist movement, there's no doubt about that. But later on, when I took charge of the CID, I had access to all of the various things like that. There's no doubt that they had to be thorough in their observation, and reports were made from time to time which is represented in the Barnett period. But I believe that the manner of agitation of our people was responsible for a very favorable impression in creating the mind of the whole office, the colonial office in UK, in that we did not go the whole hog as India did. So I think that there was sympathetic upkeeper. You know, always in England there are liberal men, many government. And I think that the people appointed the commissions and the pace at which they kept even more and more responsibility here was the result of the partly of special branch reports of the, shall we say, the controlled manner in which our leaders were agitated. We might have used, you know, if I had not been in this, I might have been a student, you know, a young man wishing for a violent demonstration. But our leaders were
right. And presumably you were kept in touch with the movement to some extent through personal friendships and also your brother's family's interest.
And my father himself?
Yes.
So I knew it more than in fact very often at police conferences and things like that. I used to be able to advise or offer certain suggestions from my personal knowledge of the tape of things outside. I don't think I ever had to contradict the special branch of war, which sometimes were brought to regular discussion at officers' conferences. But I was able more than once to correct and approach to it.
Would this mean that in the 30s and 40s, even DSA 90 might have been followed at times?
Oh, yes, no doubt about it. No doubt about it. Under observation, reported on.
But then, through the Minister of Home Affairs, wouldn't he have been aware of the
No. Oh, no. Confidential reports at that time. Yes, it was a direct British administration. If not on paper, at least orally.
You mentioned these officers' conferences and the fact that sometimes some matters were raised there. In what sort of matter, let's say, special branch things?
Any matter which at the time was topical and important enough for general discussion, where a policy had to be revised or strengthened, any such thing. So if you were expecting any communal trouble or any agitation from labor union people, then those matters were discussed. And we were advised and briefed so that we in the provinces and outstations, on the information given us here, we started being more alert.
We didn't get involved in making law and order on the estates and overseas estates just before the war or just as the war began, somewhere around there.
Why not? I'll tell you the time.
39, 40, no,
yes. Oh, yes. At that time, I wasn't stationed to no area. There was a very big strike on Rambo district. I was sent up for 2 weeks to no area.
And was it of a military tempo?
Yes, yes. There was a, at the time I was sent, the depot police, which used to provide our striking forces, had been called out to Rambo. There was a party of depot men on the estate. They had in fact fired and killed a couple of laborers. That was the situation when I went there. At that time there was trouble particularly in Uber and in Central Province. Not so much in Sabrodhana.
Did you feel that these strikes were engineered from outside or kind of spontaneous outgrowth from especially Greers?
No, no. Engineered and set up by the NSS. At that time they were very strong. And the actual Indian labor organizations, which are now represented by Mr. Condaman and Aziz and people, they were not so militant. They were more on the side of the management and they were against LSS. So they found LSSP getting a footing. And this was the period where the LSSP really got established within the state union by means of these agitation and strikes.
How do you know that these people were against the LSS? Did they come to you or?
Well, the point is, in most of those strikes, the labor divided itself automatically into two groups, loyal and disloyal labor, as it were, meaning loyal to the management and disloyal to the management. Now, when I went to Rambo, was a group of about 400 laborers who left the estate as a result of police action. And there was an equal or larger amount of labor on the estate working as loyal labor. And one of the problems was how to protect and how to prevent friction between the loyal and disloyal labor groups and their dependents still living on the estate. The disloyal labor had left. Their families were on the estate. The loyal labor was supposed to be victimizing the wives and children, all of the disloyal that had left the estate. So naturally we have a lot of contact with both sides. I mean, Rampoda, I met the strikers who were by then all moved to Lower Delhi and were processing, you know, moving about in procession, being in Lower Delhi. So I met both groups, the leaders and everybody.
Now the leaders mean?
LSS leaders, Chacha and Lim personally.
Who were they on the
street? At that time, Lower Delhi was the safer was there. That called Abhyas Tishtinga was there, who is now strong UNP killer. All the men, Lenji Dumar, the visitor there, came back. All the top men were there, but they were more preoccupied with whoever their big strikes had their key estates. And Moolaya was a little different in point of time. Moolaya was also a central province strike, but that did not have a particular period I'm talking about. This time there was a place called Vedasa in Bandhila, another place in Bandhila, and this is from the village.
They would have had Jack Kotalawala there.
Jack was in Kumbha. I think it was in Pala Sampo was there. The union leader who was up in Lower Delhi. I remember meeting them and talking to them. And I didn't want to say, you know, please just go back to work, you see. Feeling the union leader, but at last we succeeded. We posted them back to the state.
What
was
the plan
for his
attitude? I mean,
it was actually an interesting incident. When I went to Rambodo, I think there was a chap called Bartlett, very senior, 62 old British plant. And he was in the estate and he was quite delighted that he got rid of the disloyal labor and that only the loyal labor was working and that the police had fired on him, such and things like that. So when I went up there, I told him I'd like to have a conversation on the estate with groups representing the loyal and the disloyal, which was me. My whole idea of stopping sort of trading in Lower Delhi and sending them back to the state, accepting this, not to keep it as a sort of warfare. And I thought the sooner we should cut back to work the better, otherwise there would be a problem, a social problem, the family would have been starving. So I found that they beat me. You see, they were begging actually on the streets of Lower Delhi for money, and the union wasn't strong enough to maintain them. That was the situation, right, bring them back. Bartlett refused. He said, he would have it. So I told him, must, you see, I think it was the first time Bartlett had found that the police were not going to be dictated to by the senior British planter on a matter like this, where normally the attitude would be what the planter says is right. So then he called in law, and then he called moderate, the senior planter there, moderate guy, not quite sure. Who held in the planter's work and had a big conference in Lower Delhi on this question of my wanting to meet them at the estate. He said, you can talk to them outside and you can come and talk to the loyal chaps here. I said, no, I'm going to talk to both groups together. Because I was infested by these complaints of harassment of the resident women. You know. And I thought, this is one of the ways of settling it. By pointing out to the Lower Delhi, that you wasn't dependent to come back and work, and then you talk to your people and you guarantee your prosecution on the estate. We had a conference and I remember this, definitely a moderator of it. He said, you don't know Indian labor as I do. So I was young, Indian and arrogant, so I said, Mr. Mokhala, Mr. Bartlett, you don't know me. I said, that's why you say that. I said, I have a way with Indian labor, which I had to say. You're my personal experience. I said, I have a way with Indian labor. And you get me, I said, you need to do it. He said, right, the responsibility is yours. Then you said, I said, yes, that's what I'm telling you. The responsibility is mine. You can't go howling for the police. And then tell the senior policeman that he has no say. So I have a challenge. It is my responsibility. So he very reluctant. He tried to get through to my SP in Canning. Fortunately, there had been rain and floods, and then he just needed to get through to him on the phone. I said, I've got no time to wait, and unless you agree, I'm taking steps back to this city. I'll take you to a police truck or something. See? So he agreed, and actually, that was the end of the story. I took the letter.
So at this conference of the two groups, were there any illicit
feelings? No. I said I didn't want anybody. I said, when I'm talking only to labor. And I must say to Obak that after the he came to my office in New York about a week later, he watched it for about a week. And he came and thanked me and he said that, when you said you are a great Indian labor, naturally. I must say that you had something like that, which was as handsome an apology as you could get from somebody. Of course, feelings were very strange, you know, about it and myself.
Who was the strong, bigger group on that occasion? The Lichnauer or the
Lichnauer? That's why they were able to keep this thing going.
What about the big strikes in 46, 47? Were you in Colombo then?
46, 47.
All these government servants, clerks, and...
I'll tell you where I was in 46, 47. I don't recall. 46. Oh, why not? I was in the police training school. That's why I was on. And the art chapter used in units in different places, but I was not really in practicals of police work. I was training. That's why when the actual date to it, I took it once.
Well, it was, I was kind of like vague as a youngster. It was a general strike, two general strikes, one in 46, one in 47, and in one company got shot and become a martyr,
On those occasions, our training school units were called out where things were very bad. But as a general rule, the training school, of course, had no direct contact with those things.
I'm interested in the health pictures of some of the leading policemen. That would be Dean, Banks, Ferguson, O'Hallan?
O'Hallan.
And then Bacon.
Bacon, that's right. That was the sequence you had to do. Dean, Banks, Helen, Bacon, that's good.
I'm also interested in Ferguson, who was the IGS.
Now Ferguson, if you would like me to talk of him first, he is relevant to what we've already discussed in the Bracelet method. It was Ferguson's thoroughness and method which made it possible for Banks to establish all he did in that inquiry. Banks was more superficial, although he was the DIG of the CID. Ferguson was really the brains in the CID. He was superintendent of the special branch and of the CID. And he was a very thorough man and a first-class policeman. Was he who kept a record and a note of everything, got authentication wherever it was possible to visit in any manner, and also D.B. had forgotten that he had initialed a confidential report which Ferguson had requested him to initiate. At the time of presentation, Ferguson and Banks had gone together and discussed the whole matter. The final decision had been made, and Ferguson had got also D.B. to initial the document, which D.B. had forgotten. And he denied that such a document existed and various things like that.
And got into a mess.
Yes. Now Ferguson, that was typical of him. He was a good policeman and very thorough, very far-sighted, and quite rightly as any good policeman should be. He didn't trust many people, you see. So he got through that way, and he was a good man. He ended up as, he was knighted, and he became a very important official in the British colonial office, I think.
What was his attitude to people? I mean, was he, would you class him as a more liberal type?
Yes, or? Different. He was a policeman and nothing more. He was not a politician, he was not an imperialist. Very, very nice man to get on with. Very pleasant. Not the type of uniform police officer one thinks of. He was really a first-class, plainclothes CID man. And even in his special branch work, he did what he did, not out of any interest in protecting imperialist government, but purely because it was his job to do so. He was one of the best policemen of the old British group that I could remember, as a policeman, as my conception of a policeman was. He would have fitted into any police service in the world, I feel, whereas some of the others were useful as policemen because of their imperialist loyalty. Dogmatism is absolutely in a class by himself. These are qualities which nobody else that I have associated with that as a teacher. Admittedly, he was the old school and he directed work on lines which were more or less handed down to him. But his energy, his capacity for planning, his memory, his devotion to his job, his drive, I think he was a wonderful boss for a young cat to work under. Because if you absorb any sense of what he showed you, not what he told you, what he showed you, you really learn how to set about a job. His perspective may have been wrong. It's a different matter. See, doesn't that, you know? I remember, get terrific out. Once, police station, a policeman, they have bus offences. At an officers' conference, I brought this up, and I said, it's an utter waste of time for policemen to be charging for those traveling on the footboard. And I said, not police work. So they're making our men dishonest by doing that. His idea was the number of minor offences a policeman brings in should be a guide to his efficiency. I said, it's rubbish. I said, it's the type of minor offence. I said, so nearly opening the door to dishonesty. Now, on that, they have a terrific difference of opinion and delayed grounds and instrument of mine and various things, but that's why I say his perspective may have been from our point of view wrong. I'd be gracious. I must say that I've yet outside literature, history, to find a character so completely on the ball in his job. He made the police service a discipline and really its organization. Everything he built into it, you see, was really core. And
that would seem to have been an entirely different type, and he was lucky to get the post of IGP.
I would agree that on his own merits, he might not have been appointed IGP. But as the legitimate successor to Dobby, I say he kept the machine going quite well. And he did this. He brought a little more, shall we say, good humor into aggression. If Daubigin only criticism at such times, you're always under the sense of strain. There was no relaxing, except for the mess party. I mean, work was one dead level of intense seriousness, you see. Even in supervision, anything, even the cracking of a joke was almost unbearable. Now Banks made it even more human. A conversation with Banks, even when he pulled you up, and he pulled up quite effectively, he made it a little more friendly. And maybe it became more effective in that way for the more intelligent type of subordinate. You see, he reacted more favorably with that type of thing. So he's going in my mess up here. So he's going there. And actually, I put this, I think I'll put this down. Solve the problem. That's, I wouldn't say, was a failure of IG. He was handed over a machine in many disorder. Banks ran into difficulties because at that very time was a period of political transfer of power. Dobigin now was pulled out and he could have gone on to 2 years more because he saw it come. And he knew he couldn't reject something. Banks tried to reject something. But the best of it is really to the strength. He said, D.B. and D.B. got their nice into him. As a result, the day was coming for him, and they were able to persuade him to send his paper to Georgia.
Well, I heard from a teacher that there were also problems arising from the fact that he was very bad in debt.
So that is how they got him on. That is how they got him on some debt. You see, and I can tell you that how unfair it was for the government to have treated him. That day during the war, Bagels and Miggers sent a note out to all their people who owed them any money. Two banks had discovered them, and but he was helped with money from home. And he was settling his dues every now and then, always ran into it. But he was not in debt in any way that upset his ministry, the police service, in that it was not a matter of public knowledge. So he got a letter from either Cardinal or Miller or something, asking to pay up immediately this debt, or otherwise they'd take legal action or something like that. And he was very annoyed about this because he had kept paying, though irregularly. So So on that issue, he told them to go to Kailash. See, and then they reported him to Sudeva.
They got a handle.
Yes, sir. And then he was that type of man. Is it that you want me to go? They said, yes, that's it. They got a chance. Given that he was so indebted, now he has his officers. He would have known, oh, that's it. Nothing in life, except that he was extravagant, he was a good leader, he was very fond of society. Such a contrast on Dalbigal, who was a bachelor, confirmed bachelor, had no interest outside the police service. That's it.
Helen?
Well, Helen, of course, came in as a result of events, which is good. You do question that the service was an absolutely corrupt and shocking mess, you see, because the politicians brought Helen in. Helen was the first IDP whom the civilians asked for an appointment. So they took Helen as their man, but they didn't realize what sort of man they got. He gave him the fixed idea that banks and the old British regime had to be distributed. And he set about trying to do that. But he was absolutely crooked administrator. In that, just to prove his picture, he wrote the most fantastic report. You see, some of it we were able to see. And it went eventually to the police committee in 1947. Because we, some of us, still determined major part in that matter. And we were able to contest the subject matter of Helen's reports and things like that. He was a shocking administrator. He tried to prove absolutely falsely that the previous British regime has been completely inefficient, corrupt, and unworthy. He was very wrong in that.
Didn't he bring certain Indian ideas?
I don't know where he got his ideas. He did a few good things. He certainly got to at least more funds, more transport, more amenities, and all that from the politicians, because they were all out to win what he wanted. More staff, even slight increases in pay. But his administration was dreadfully bad.
I thought he ran some conflict with the politicians in the
Dayton, and if you're not, he had to go, and his successor, Dayton, had to go as a result of the police commission.
Right.
Because it was found that they had misrepresented people, and they were unsuitable to run the police. That's the answer Richard Ali Hamilton brought. Oh, for instance, he tried, he succeeded in creating a terrific rift here in Ceylon between the promoted police inspector type, that is those who joined the police in the inspectors and constabulary, as opposed to officers. He was a complete opponent of that, which was accepted here. He didn't like the public school boy type of British officer, and he preferred the professional policeman. So he tried to prove there was no need for appointments of senior officers of any higher levels, and the constables should really work with him. He may be all right in the British society, not here.
Who was it, Helen or Baker?
Helen. Baker was a different man. Baker, if he'd come in ordinarily as an IGP, he would be perfectly acceptable. But Baker was Helen's legitimate successor and was associated with Helen in some Helen's reports and policies. So he had to go there. Baker was a very good man. Now, Baker was more a bad style of business, you see. But Baker had no ability on his own, I think, as a Christian. His training and all that had been good. But unfortunately, he was Helen's successor and had to carry the responsibility for part of Helen's administration.
Wasn't Helen an arrogant type when he had...
Yes. Yes. Very clear. I think just the politicians, he, for the outside of the hill, he was worse than Indian, he was British officer angry in his manner.
That means he was bound to rub the politicians the wrong way.
Literally. Yes. He was a complete mystery. Baker, I would think, could very well have gone out as an IGP here. He quite acceptable if it were not for the legacy of Helen. In fact, when we gave evidence before the police commission, a large application the only duplication which is attached to the sea, the new idea. I think I will not be going to see the commissioner and Bhagavad suggestions were born in the report. He told that Bacon was to keep the 50 ID, had it not been for his association with Harry. So he was going to get him a complete break and introduce the Sudanese ID at that stage.
I was wondering if we could shift there.
Yes, certainly. Yes.
Oh. You mentioned Helen's report. What were the main points he made?
He was particularly anxious to alter completely our administrative system and give the CID complete independence of the uniformed administration. That was one of the things he wanted. The other thing was he wanted to scrap this system of direct recruitment at higher levels. Both those were errors, grave errors in the context of our own country and our social conditions. And it led to utter confusion and great disunity in the peace. You see, he was trying to introduce a system which went further than the British Scotland Yard system. There, you know, you've got provincial borough police station. It's a different matter. But there should be a parent, sort of CID, which goes out and assists them and runs serious crime investigation. That is their system, and I cannot comment on that too deeply now. I have my views. But here in Ceylon,